Times ABC News. Listen.
I'm deeply gratified by the support I received on the rules fight tonight, but not quite as gratified as President Carter.
He must explain and defend the last 4 years. And he must explain the grave state of this nation today.
When Billy went on a wagon, the sales just plummeted. I mean, they went to hell in a beer can quick.
From ABC News, the people and stories that made this week's world news.
The 38th Quadrennial Convention of the Democratic Party of the United States will please come to order.
The convention may have renominated President Carter and Vice President Mondale, but few would argue that the spirit of the convention belonged to Senator Ted Kennedy. The first question facing the convention was a rules question. Must delegates vote on the first ballot for the candidate they were selected to represent? New York Governor Hugh Carey thought not.
A man could commit a triple axe homicide on his wife and still be nominated because you can't change the vote. Now, does the Democratic Party want to put itself into that?
The Kennedy delegates at the convention agreed with Governor Kerry. The Carter delegates did not. San Francisco Mayor Dianne Feinstein explained.
I say to you as a Democrat who works for John F. Kennedy, who works for Robert Kennedy, but who is now a Carter delegate, that we don't change the rules after the game has been played.
Carter forces won the rules debate on an open convention, effectively signaling the end of any chance for a Kennedy victory at the convention. Senator Kennedy talked to his supporters Monday night.
I have called President Carter and congratulated him. The efforts on the nomination is over. My name will not be placed in nomination, but the efforts for democratic principles must and will continue.
Many Kennedy loyalists did not take defeat kindly. Some delegates left the convention so they would not have to support President Carter in the fall. But others, like Kennedy delegate Thomas Cronin of Colorado, indicated a willingness to unite for the Democratic cause.
Governor Reagan will be the factor that unites the Democratic Party and brings Senator Kennedy's forces and supporters back behind the Democratic ticket.
Monday night, in his keynote address to the convention, Congressman Morris Udall tried to make the party's peace with the last of the men from Camelot.
A year ago, congressmen, governors, and party leaders all over the country were saying, you got to run, you got to save us. And Senator Kennedy was leading everyone in the polls at that time. And he picked up his sword and said, all right, I'll go into battle. And he got out and put on his armor and picked up his sword. And he looked back, and a lot of people who'd been telling him to run weren't there anymore. I know that he's disappointed, but he fought a great fight, and we all owe him a debt of gratitude.
Tuesday night, Senator Kennedy was out of the presidential race, but was still contending strongly for the right to shape the Democratic platform. The senator took to the podium to appeal for the planks nearest his heart.
Woe those who inhabit our land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Let us provide new hope that prosperity shall not be purchased by poisoning the air, the rivers, and the natural resources that are the greatest gift of this continent.
And Kennedy appealed for support of his economic vision.
To all those who are idle in the cities and industries of America, let us provide new hope for the dignity of useful work. Democrats have always believed that a basic civil right of all Americans is that their right to earn their own way. The party of the people must always be the party of full employment.
He also pushed for his concept of national health insurance.
If health insurance is good enough for the president, the vice president, the Congress of the United States, then it's good enough for you and every family in America.
Kennedy ended his speech with a pledge.
For me, a few hours ago, this campaign came to an end. For all those whose cares have been our concern, the work goes on, the cause endures, the hope still lives, and the dream shall never die.
Evidently, it was not only Kennedy partisans who were cheering the senator. The next night, President Carter said,
last night, after one of the greatest speeches I have ever heard, I called Senator Kennedy and told him how much I appreciate it.
Going into the convention and even after the senator's withdrawal, much was made of the policy differences between Carter and Kennedy, but Vice President Mondale made light of them.
We agree on objectives. Both Senator Kennedy and President Carter want a fully employed economy and a socially just America and foreign policy that reflects American values. I don't see any fundamental disputes here.
Wednesday was set aside for the nomination of President Carter as the Democratic presidential nominee. By the very early hours of Thursday morning, Senator Kennedy had issued a statement endorsing the president and the platform. Kennedy also gave some instructions to the leader of the Massachusetts delegation, Thomas O'Neill III, son of House Speaker and Convention Chairman Tip O'Neill.
To help make Jimmy Carter the next president of these United States in a re-election form, Massachusetts would like to be the first state of the 50 United States to move for acclamation. On behalf of Secretary.
Thursday was the last day of the convention. It saw the renomination of the vice president and acceptance speeches by both Walter Mondale and Jimmy Carter. The vice president used his time to take on the Republicans.
The Republican Party has been out of step with America for 50 years, and their nominee is out of step more than any of them.
Mondale closed his speech with a note of inspiration.
We are blessed to be Americans. We are an example to the world. Don't let anyone tell you that we're less than we've been. And don't let anyone make us less than we can be. Thank you.
Then it was time for President Carter to enter Madison Square Garden as the Democratic champion. President Carter warned the Democrats against failure in November.
The choice between the two futures could not be more clear. If we succumb to a dream world, then we'll wake up to a nightmare.
The president promised the Democrats a tough campaign.
Fritz and I will mount a campaign that defines the real issues. A campaign that responds to the intelligence of the American people. A campaign that talks sense. And we're going to beat the Republicans in November.
And the president appealed to his Democratic challenger.
I reach out to you tonight, and I reach out to all those who supported you in your valiant and passionate campaign. Ted, your party needs, and I need you.
After his speech, President Carter was joined on the platform, very briefly, by an unsmiling Ted Kennedy. The two men shook hands, then Kennedy left. Back at his McLean, Virginia home the next day, the senator denied that he had snubbed the president.
It was President Carter's night, and no one should forget it. So I was there to congratulate him, and I did, and I welcomed him, joined with other Democrats.
The other major political news of the week came from the nonpartisan League of Women Voters. Three presidential debates will be held this year, probably in Baltimore, Maryland, Portland, Oregon, and Cleveland, Ohio. According to League spokesman Ruth Heinerfeld, independent presidential candidate John Anderson has a chance to participate.
Any candidate who has achieved 15% or better, any independent or non-major party candidate who achieves 15% or better will be invited to participate in the series of debates, as will any independent or third-party candidate who achieves a standing equal to that of one of the major party candidates.
Not surprisingly, Anderson was pleased.
I am very pleased with the announcement by the League today, and it assures me that I will be able to meet each and every one of the criteria that they have called for as a participant in the debate.
John Anderson also picked a new campaign manager, former Republican Party co-chairman Mary Crisp.
My party, for me, has violated some very fundamental beliefs that I have in my party. So consequently, I am voting for John and working very hard for him.
John Anderson is just one of the imponderables so far in the race for the White House this fall. There is also the matter of the president's brother, Billy Carter. Indiana Senator Birch Bayh chairs the committee investigating Billy's relations with Libya, among other things. And he announced that former federal judge Philip Tone, a Republican, would serve as special counsel to the committee.
It's a very delicate kind of situation. Watergate and that investigation took place after the election. This is just before the election. election, and I think Judge Tone has a tremendous responsibility. I think he can carry it, to walk that narrow balance and carry that investigation on at a pace that will expedite it, but do it at a pace that's prudent and not rushing to judgment.
Tone himself thinks the Billy Carter investigation may take a while.
In my opinion, we are not going to be able to complete the hearings by Labor Day. I think the information that has developed and presumably developed since Senator Bayh expressed that hope has indicated that we can't finish the hearings by then.
In an announcement that could serve to further slow the process, a spokesman for Senator Robert Dole said that committee member would like to see the committee's investigation broadened to include other Carter relatives.
The relatives, of course, include Billy Carter, whose relationship with Libby is quite well known. But also we've learned in recent days that the president's son, Jeff, was involved in business dealings in the Philippines, including sale of computer technology, and was quite well treated there by the Marcos family. And Ruth Carter Stapleton, the president's sister, toured the Arab world courtesy of a pro-Arab U.S. businessman.
How does Billy feel about all this attention?
I don't like to use the word persecuted. I think I'm being harassed as hell.
Billy's notoriety these days has brought about a resurgence of that almost forgotten brew, Billy Beer. In Seattle, at the FX McRory Whiskey Bar, Mick McHugh explains.
We're selling it for $2 a can, limit one can per person. And with Billy being in the limelight here, we thought that he deserved a little positive image here, so we made sure that the proceeds of this beer, which is now, under the circumstances, a true collector's item, goes to an altruistic cause.
The cause is a Seattle wildlife clinic. You might think $2 a can a bit steep for beer, even at a charity sale, but watch out. At the rate food and other prices are increasing, that may be the going rate sooner than you might expect. The government's producer price index, wholesale prices to you and me, jumped 1.7% last month, the biggest increase since 1974. And which item was mostly to blame? If you said food, Dennis Stedman of Chase Econometrics says you're right.
We think that at the retail level, consumer food prices will rise by 11 to 12% in 1981. Over 1980 levels. That would be the highest food price inflation that we've had in several years.
Stedman says while poultry prices increased the most, 24% last month because of the heat wave, the real concern lies elsewhere.
What I think is more alarming, although the numbers aren't as large, is the increase in beef, veal, and pork. As I say, the numbers are not as impressive or overwhelming, but those are the increases that we're going to see continue month after month for the rest of the year, unlike the poultry increase, which may, in fact, be a 1 or 2 month phenomenon.
In spite of present and projected wholesale price increases for food, a study by the Purdue University School of Consumer and Family Sciences says eating out, at least fast food style, can be cheaper than eating in. Professor Lee Kruhl says for a family of four, a chicken dinner is a couple of dollars cheaper out than at home. And for the single person, the saving is even larger.
To prepare a meal such as Kentucky Fried Chicken at home would be $4.82. To purchase it from the restaurant would be $2.41.
Retail sales figures released by the government this week showed increases for a second month in a row, although sales for the last 12 months are down. Down, too, were American auto sales. But surprise, of the big three, Chrysler turned in the best performance. Its sales were only 10% below this time last year. General Motors dropped 31% below last year, and Ford sales declined 39%. Like Chrysler, Ford is pinning a lot of hope on public reaction to their new line of smaller front-wheel drive cars. The first of the Ford Escorts and Mercury Lynx rolled off the assembly lines this week. And Joe Barson, president of a UAW Local 900 in Wayne, Michigan, where the cars are being built, gave his members a pep talk.
We will build you the quality if you give us engineering. This is the most key thing into it. And there's nobody in the world. We saw them. Japanese come over here to learn to build a car. We showed them how it's done, and we will show them, and this is the car we'll do it. For all this, I want to thank you.
From our You Can't Fight City Hall department comes word that you can. If you're the Gray Panthers, The Senior Citizens Group challenged the Treasury Department's advertising of U.S. savings bonds. And Gray Panther Steering Committee member Thelma Rutherford explains why.
It was false advertisement. It was not saving your money to the best of your ability because they weren't paying that much interest on, and still aren't. 7% is the new rate, which is pretty good, but that's not as good as what you can get off of these new certificates of deposit.
The Treasury Department has agreed to change the ads. It is becoming increasingly clear that some of the Cubans who came here on the boat lift months ago have found America to be less than they expected. Federal authorities say that seems to explain the rash of airline hijackings that have occurred. No one has been injured. Mark Bell of Houston, Texas, was a passenger on one of the hijacked jets.
I figured nobody was probably going to get hurt because the last thing that guy, he didn't look like a terrorist. He just looked like he wanted to get home to Cuba. You know, he didn't look like he wanted to hurt anybody, let alone himself.
The hijackings have been accomplished with a bar of soap disguised as an explosive device and bottles full of gasoline. Security experts like Richard Lally say U.S. airport security systems are effective, but they just can't detect those kinds of items.
We probably inspect at the U.S. airports probably 500 million people a year. And among those people, we usually pick up about over 2,000 weapons. And number of people, also like 1,000 people, are arrested every year.
Miami International Airport Security Director Eddie Hammond says they have to treat everything cautiously.
There would be very little to do to prevent something like that from happening as far as not allowing the passenger on the airplane with a bar of soap. And once he got on the airplane and the aircraft is at 30,000 feet and he makes an overt action of an attempted hijacking with one of the crew members, the pilot naturally not being absolutely positive 100% that that is not in fact a stick of dynamite or a bomb is not going to take the chance.
ABC's Bob Serkin says in an effort to screen out hijackers, you may get a good hard look from the next airline ticket agent you approach.
The FAA and the airlines are talking about reinstituting the behavioral profile system, which was dropped in the late 60s for 100% screening with electronic devices. That behavioral system involves ticket agents screening passengers using certain characteristics. For instance, a person buying a one-way ticket with cash might be detained for questioning. He might be suspicious.
We thought one of our big stories this week would be the devastation caused by Hurricane Allen. But for once, we're glad to be disappointed. Hurricane forecaster Dr. Neil Frank says Allen was huge, even for a hurricane.
Even though the overall cloud shield may be 400 or 500 miles, it's that interior 50-mile core that we worry about, and it was that core that passed just north of Brownsville, south of Corpus Christi, and so the damage they had down there was much less than it could have been.
What seems to have helped save the coast of Texas was Allen's long pause just offshore, but the wait made some Corpus Christi residents, like Barbara Gruen, wish things had moved a little faster, as she told ABC's Al Dale.
I got pretty nervous. This is my first one. I'm from Fort Worth, and I've been here about a month, so I've never gone through anything. So it was pretty, I was pretty scared, but maybe that was just me.
And then when it turned out the way it did, how'd you feel?
Relieved. I'm ready to go home and take a shower.
Also in Corpus Christi, Lillian Blanco says the Red Cross shelter was okay, but there's no place like home.
I feel very happy because I didn't know how long I was going to be there, and I was worried about my house. Things were very rough when I left, and I wasn't sure I'd have a house left when I got back. I'm very grateful to see that there doesn't appear to be hardly any damage. And I just feel great. It's just, you know, I'm at home. Hooray.
The hurricane forecasters were glad to get Allen over with, too, Dr. Neil Frank.
There are six of us here, and we work three shifts a day, so two of us were on each of those shifts as the hurricane was making landfall. Now, I can go back into the period today and fall back on just one hurricane forecaster on duty around the clock. So that gives us an opportunity to get a day off and for people to get on home.
A new forecaster was heard from this week. Charlotte King of Salem, Oregon, says she hears things and gets headaches before earthquakes and volcanic eruptions.
As of June of 80, I had heard and predicted earthquakes accurately for a full year. They didn't matter really where they had been. And in March of this year, 1980, March 16th exact, I heard the sound change, but I had a severe headache. And I'd never had a headache with it before, so that was kind of unusual. And 4 days later, the first earthquake hit on Mount St. Helens.
Tuesday, a team of three geologists descended into the crater of Mount St. Helens, despite the fact that it keeps puffing smoke and ash every few days. Geologist Jane Banks describes what it felt like as they went in.
Dante's Inferno kept coming to my mind, and it was like a scene from what you would expect hell to be, of course, without any of the suffering, but visually.
What do you see inside a volcano?
It's hot and steamy, and sometimes your visibility is all grayness, and other times the wind takes some of the steam and fume away, and you can see the structure in the walls of the mountain, and it's beautiful, and it's awesome, and it's scary.
Some people probably think venturing inside the damaged 3 Mile Island nuclear reactor building would be pretty scary, too. But that's what four men did Friday morning, and TMI official Robert Arnold tells us what the men found.
We first of all got our first direct radiation readings in major areas of the, what we call the operating floor of the containment building, and they were encouraging in the sense that they were about half of what we had anticipated they'd be.
However, lower radiation readings or no, it will still take years, according to the latest reports, to clean up all that radioactive mess. A research expedition has found what it believes to be the wreck of the ocean liner Titanic. After 2.5 weeks of searching in the icy waters of the North Atlantic, the scientists think the ship is located 380 miles off the coast of Newfoundland in over 12,000 feet of water. 1,500 people were drowned when the so-called unsinkable ship went down after striking an iceberg. We ask the author of the bestseller, Raise the Titanic, Clive Cussler, if he thinks we'll ever see the ship on the surface again.
The cost would just be utterly astounding. I think you're talking $3 to $4 billion to actually raise the Titanic, bringing up 47,000 tons of steel from 2.5 miles below the sea. Technology behind it we really don't have. We won't see the Titanic raised in our lifetime.
We'd like you to make the acquaintance of a man we first heard about this week, Illinois state champion hog caller Frank Greenwald. Frank lives in Granite City, Illinois, and he says he's never even owned a hog. Well, naturally, we wanted to know how he could be sure he had the right kind of hog call to call hogs if he never got to really use it. And he told us he did get to try it out from time to time, most recently when he and a friend were on a hunting trip in Iowa.
I got to call him, and this is the truth now. This large herd of hogs, they just got milling into a great big circle, and they just ran up towards the hog farm. And my friend says, by God, Frank, he said, if I hadn't seen it, I'd never believed it. He says, you sure are the champion.
Now, we aren't hog call experts, but we thought you'd like to hear the Illinois state champion hog call, so we asked Frank if he'd oblige us. Are the people and stories and sounds that made world news this week. World News This Week was written and produced by Penny C. Dixon, directed by Barbara Silver, engineering by Mary Jean Grisenda and Brian Wilson. I'm John Grimes, ABC News, New York. World News This Week is a presentation of ABC News.